Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. At around noon today, the 24-hour ban on U.S.-based airlines flights to Tel Aviv will end, and we will see if it gets extended. The ban was a response to reports of Hamas rockets landing near the airport there and comes just as people are asking questions about why the Malaysian Airlines plane was allowed to be routed over the war zone in eastern Ukraine. Barbara Peterson, who covers aviation for Condé Nast Traveler, joins us now to talk about this very rare move by Washington. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to WNYC. Barbara Peterson, can you hear me? All right. We'll get her up in just a second here. Listeners, if you've got ties to Israel or Gaza, are you canceling any travel plans you might have had for this summer? 212-433-WNYC. You'll be a part of this segment. 212-433-9692. Call in and tell us how the fighting there and the travel bans and warnings are affecting you if you've got ties to Israel or Gaza. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Barbara Peterson from Condé Nast Traveler, you there? All right. And we're also going to be joined in a minute by a pilot and former FAA official, Jacques Astray. He is in New Delhi today, but he's got experience at this part of the FAA. Another thing, listeners, that you might chime in on is whether you've ever seen anything like this before. Have you ever tried to fly or wanted to fly to somewhere, but you were told that, U.S.-based airlines are not allowed to go? How rare is this? 212-433-WNYC. Or if you have ties to Israel and Gaza and had travel plans and now you're reconsidering them or deciding, hey, I'm going anyway. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. One thing that I think that people haven't understood very well about this 24-hour ban is that it does not affect all flights to Tel Aviv originating in the U.S. It just affects U.S.-based airlines. So, for example, you might have heard that former Mayor Bloomberg flew out to Tel Aviv yesterday or today under this ban to show solidarity with Israel on LL, which is the Israeli national airline. LL is still flying, including from U.S. airports. The ban that the government can control is on the U.S.-based carriers. Now I think we have Barbara Peterson from Condé Nast Traveler. Barbara?
Yes?
Hi there. Sorry for whatever technical problems.
Glad we connected.
Do they do this to protect against rockets coming from Gaza at this time because of what just happened in eastern Ukraine?
Well, yes. I think what a lot of people in the aviation industry are thinking is this is partially in a reaction to that. And of course, some people are saying it's an overreaction. And that's basically because it is such an extraordinary move to take. It is, well, in effect, everything that's going on right now is almost unprecedented. Of course, in the wake of what happened in the Ukraine with Malaysia Air Flight 17, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing going on about, oh, maybe we should have issued more dire warnings. Maybe there should have been an actual ban. Of course, it's too late now for that flight and the people on it. So it's understandable that it's a very tense situation right now. And now I think the feeling is, well, if we have to err in the other direction, then let's do that. But, of course, the FAA, and I believe you pointed this out too, really doesn't have authority over foreign airlines operating in foreign airspace. So it's really just a guidance, if you will, to other airlines. A lot of airlines around the world will follow what the FAA does, just out of, again, caution.
And some other nations' airlines actually led on this, right? Before the FAA issued its 24-hour ban on U.S. airlines going there yesterday, weren't Air France and some others from other countries already voluntarily deciding it was not safe to fly to Tel Aviv?
Yes, they several airlines just, you know, unilaterally took that move. And also, in a sense, that's analogous to what happened last week, too. It came out that some European airlines had already decided to avoid the area completely where the downing of the Malaysia jet took place.
Let's take a phone call from Stephen Riverdale. Steve, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
What I was saying is I lived in Israel during the first Gulf War, and I happened to be in the States with my family and then went back. And I remember I flew in El Al, but all the other airlines had stopped flying, except for El Al, possibly Tower or another Israeli one.
So that was at the time when Saddam Hussein's government was lobbing Scud missiles into Israel as its response to the U.S. invading it because it invaded Kuwait, right?
That's right. He was such a coward that he did it all at night so he wouldn't be tracked, and it certainly disrupted sleep patterns. But
right. And what about, Steve, do you know in other periods of war, the 1967 war, the 1973 war, do you happen to know if U.S. airlines stop flying?
I don't know. I was a teenager. I was in college then.
Right. Then I'm going to leave it there. And I thank you for your story and adding to the history of this in the way you did. Barbara, do you know? Because it's so, you know, unusual to do this for all the decades of the endless Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Steve reminds us of a time where they did it during the first Gulf War. But has it happened before and other times?
Oh, yes. I think, you know, these things do happen when there's really a war going on, a conflict where there might be missiles being fired. Yes, it does happen a lot. I think because it often happens in areas where, you know, let's put it this way, not a lot of people are flying, you know, to Iraq anyway. So it tends not to get reported as widely. You know, I'm talking about people who might be just civilian passengers flying to places like that. If they're hotspots, generally there's a higher level of awareness of, you know, air concerns about aircraft. But you see, all of this gets back to the essential way the aviation industry functions. Airlines rely on governments and air traffic control authorities to tell them which routes are safe and which ones aren't. They really need that information to come from the source. And I think, unfortunately, in the case of Ukraine, there was sort of a breakdown there because the Ukrainian government, which normally, you know, would be the body in charge of, okay, who can fly over our country, there was some question as whether or not they really are in control of that area. I would think right now it looks like they aren't. So when there are conflict zones like that in the world, that's when the airlines really do need to have somebody, you know, who can give them a sense of, look, is this route open or not? You know, they fly along pretty well demarcated, you know, boundaries, sort of highways of the sky, if you will. It's analogous to if you're driving, you know, driving somewhere. If a road is closed, it's closed. You know, it's unsafe. If it's open, you assume that it is safe under certain situations.
Here's an interesting take on it, I think, from Hirsch in Westchester, who sells travel insurance. Is that right, Hirsch?
Yeah, I'm an insurance agent in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I've sold hundreds of travel insurance policies. We have a relationship with a travel agent in Israel, and his travelers cannot collect on their travel insurance their cancellation coverage, which does cover terrorism. But the definition of terrorism in the policy is, quote, as defined by the U.S. government, and the insurance company is referring to the State Department in that statement, who has refused to declare these rockets as acts of terror, like the Canadian government has come out and said that is clearly acts of terror. Many Congress people have called it clearly acts of terror, and it's been something that's been very frustrating as a business person to deal with.
That's a story. I hadn't heard that before. Barbara, there's one for Condé Nast Traveler.
Oh, yes, it's very complex. Travel insurance policies, of course, have lots of different exceptions in them. And that is a fascinating one, actually, because, of course, it gets into politics there. It's, you know, one person's terrorism is another person's just, you know, situation to watch or something. So, I mean, it's a very, very difficult situation, I'm afraid. And I'm really honestly, I would not take that. I would appeal that if I could, because obviously if you can't get there, you know, because the U.S. government is saying it's not safe, that's pretty serious.
It sounds like, from the way he described it, that they might even be drawing a line that says, if your flight is canceled because of an act of terrorism in your destination, at your destination, you can collect your travel cancellation insurance. But if your flight is canceled because of a war, you can't.
Yes, precisely. But, you know, and of course, then we also have the other aspect of the situation, which is Israel is saying that it is safe to fly there.
Right.
And that to suggest otherwise is, in effect, you know, letting the other side get the advantage.
Which doesn't help the travel insurance claim very much. But Israel is adamant. I guess we should really make sure to emphasize this for a moment. Israel does not like that the United States has imposed this 24-hour ban, right?
Yes, and of course, as it could be extended well beyond 24 hours, and a lot of airlines are saying they're just going to, you know, suspend until further notice, until they can be completely confident that it's safe to return.
Also joining us now, Jacques Astra, a longtime pilot who has also worked for the FAA, happens to be in New Delhi today. Hello from New York, Jacques. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello, Brian. Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Have you been a passenger plane pilot?
Yes, I have, and I also fly quite. I flew recently. I flew through or past eastern Ukraine, so I am very sensitive to that airspace.
What do you think about the fact that the U.S. government has done this? Does it surprise you? Is it consistent in your experience at the FAA and as a pilot with the kind of situation in which the U.S. would ban U.S. flights?
Well, Brian, there's a couple of things. First of all, each country has declared by ICAO rules, by the International Civil Aviation Organization's rules, the airspace over each country is sovereign to that country. So they are responsible for the airspace over which over the country, and as such, you have kind of parallel situations. You have the Ukraine, which declared that the airspace above 32,000 feet was safe to fly. You have Israel stating that the airspace, their airspace near Ben Gurion, is safe also. Yet a Scud came within a mile of the airport. So now you have to consider a couple other factors that take place in war, such as spillover. The missile in question in the Ukraine could go up to altitudes of 70,000 feet and a radius of 20 miles. So the idea that a missile would stop at exactly 32,000 feet and not hit an airliner is unrealistic. In times of war, mistakes happen, as obviously did in this case. The fact remains that even if it's a mistake, it's a tragic one and possibly criminal, or at least raised to the level of war crimes. And yes, probably the airlines now are reacting to the Ukraine situation and saying, well, why are we going to take a risk flying into Ben-Gurion and have the same thing happen there? Errant rockets and missiles, once they're launched, there's no control. That's it. So many airlines are taking the position that we're not going to take the chance. We're not going to go through the tragedy that Malaysian went through.
In fact, am I right that the U.S. didn't bar its airliners from flying over eastern Ukraine until that other plane was shot down?
That's true, Brian, but there's a caveat to that, and that was that U.S. carriers were not flying on that route either. So unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation going out about the restriction that the FAA had. For example, a lot of people thought that foreign carriers were required to follow FAA notices to airmen, which they are not. They only apply to U.S. carriers. So in the case of the Ukraine, U.S. carriers were not flying that route, but many foreign carriers were. That said, some foreign carriers mitigated the risk and said, wait a second, clearance of being allowed to fly over eastern Ukraine in a conflict zone, and it's okay up from 32,000 feet upward. Some airlines said, well, you know what? 32,000 feet doesn't guarantee that a missile's not going to hit an airplane above
And in
that
case, they were just flying over with Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. They would be landing there, so the rockets would not even have to have that much range.
And, Brian, the other thing you have to consider is that what if they have rocket-propelled grenades somewhere during the approach, which are reachable to the airplanes? They could down an airplane also. So, you know, when you consider all the possibilities and that it's a conflict zone, you have to consider the possibility of spillover and that an errant missile may just get lucky and hit a target. Unfortunately, that's what happened with Malaysian. Being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
So it sounds like you support this ban, even though so many people are calling it an overreaction, an excess of caution in what is still a relatively low-risk situation. Certainly the Israeli government is saying that.
Well, that's what they're saying, but given what just happened in the last week, some carriers are acting with an abundance of caution, which frankly, is not surprising. And if I were CEO of an airline and given the events of the last week, I would probably do the same thing.
Julie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm just calling because my babysitter, actually, who's been babysitting my son for the past 3 years and her family, they live two doors down from us. And she informed me that in the middle of the summer, they were all going to go, it's like five people in her family, were going to go to the West Bank to visit their family there. They're Palestinian Americans, but of course they have family there. Mm-hmm. And they left yesterday. And so I haven't heard of any planes downed yesterday there, but I was incredibly concerned about them. Not just because of the flight, but because I know, that it's a conflict zone and that they're going there. And
did they fly on LL to Tel Aviv? Do you know?
I actually have no idea what they flew on or what airport they're going into.
Julie, thank you. So, Barbara Peterson, to that point, do you know if Palestinians who live in the West Bank or Gaza also use the same international airlines as the Israeli Jews and basically, for the most part, fly into Tel Aviv and then commute on the ground to Gaza or the West Bank?
Well, that is the international airport in that area. So, yes. That's it.
It's the only one in the country. There's no Jerusalem International Airport in the other major city?
Oh, no. Tel Aviv is basically it. And that's one thing that people tend to forget. You know, when we talk about what terrific airport security they have there, and they're very known for that around the world, it's a different matter if you only really have one major international airport you have to worry about, and they certainly do a good job there. And I think that's one of the things, too, is that, they're known for having incredible security, and they do have systems, and anti-missile systems and things to protect the airport. So it isn't as if, it's, wide open. The question is, whom do you want to trust in this situation? If the U.S. government is actually taking the step to say, we feel that to be really 100% safe, you should avoid it, then I don't know. I think most people would actually err on the side of caution and really go with what the U.S. is going because, that way, you're not taking any chances.
And it's a
very, very tough call.
And so, Jacques, I was asked the question by one person yesterday, why are they barring U.S. airlines from flying into Tel Aviv, if that's supposed to be so unsafe, but not into Gaza, where it's actually much more dangerous? The answer is that international flights don't land in Gaza, right?
That's correct, Brian. And just to clarify the point, they're not saying Ben Gurion is absolutely dangerous and you can't fly there and it's horrible. What they're saying is they're mitigating the risk to prevent even an accidental situation.
Nathan in Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm calling with a question for everybody that right now with the ground operation, the missile activity has actually been much more dramatically curtailed than it has been for weeks, if not years. So either there is an affirmation that the missiles that have been fired into Israel for so long really are a threat that needs to be considered and dealt with, or there is another agenda, perhaps a political one, since this is putting pressure on Israel because so much tourism dollars comes in over the summer, and it's coinciding with John Kerry's trip to the region.
Nathan, thank you. Yeah, it's interesting, and I first thought this could be political for the Obama administration to tell the world that it knows Israel is under attack, but I guess that can't be it, since Israel has strenuously objected to this as sending the wrong message about public safety. And he talks about – the caller talks about the missiles being fewer during this ban. I've heard that some people fear that this could encourage Hamas – to continue or intensify the rocket fire toward the airport because they don't have to ever hit anything. You know, they just have to stay in the vicinity to scare away the planes. That's the definition of terror, terrorizing people into changing their behavior and thereby hurt Israel's economy and mobility. So the ban itself becomes political and a tool in the war on one side or another. Jock, you want to give us a last thought on that before we run out of time?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that. And I'm glad you brought that up, and I think that's why the FAA was conservative in providing only a 24-hour ban until they reconsider the situation, to give Israel that opportunity, you know, to mitigate the risk. So, you know, in fairness to both sides, you know, Israel does have a very secure policy on protecting its citizens, as does the United States. And I think that in fairness to the FAA, they only provided a 24-hour limit so that they could revisit and say, you know, is it right, or should we continue this, or should we postpone it?
So, Barbara Peterson, do you have any word? Because this 24-hour ban is going to expire in an hour or so. Have they announced yet whether they're going to extend it?
I haven't heard anything from the FAA, but what I do understand is some U.S. airlines are going to still hold off. You know, I think that they just, again, figure that they'll play on the same side. So we'll know a lot more in a few hours. And again, when you have a very volatile situation like this, it really does go hour by hour, unfortunately. So if you've got, I guess, if you've got reservations on a flight going to Tel Aviv, I would just say really just stay in touch with your airline and just monitor it, you know, frequently. And you may have to be rerouted.
And just to give a little more context on the Palestinian piece, one listener tells us that most Palestinians, or at least many, fly to Amman and then cross from Jordan into the West Bank to get to the to the Palestinian areas that way. So Barbara Peterson, who covers aviation for Condé Nast Traveler, and pilot and former FAA official Jacques Astra, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Brian. Thank you.